Hello and welcome to the Freightvine Podcast, your source for all things freight transportation. I'm Dr. Chris Kaplis, Chief Scientist at DAT Freight and Analytics, and my guest this episode is Dr. Walter Kempsies, CEO of the Kempsies Group. I've been lucky to talk with and see many presentations from Walter over the years. In my opinion, he's the preeminent as well as the most interesting economist covering global supply chains and ports. It's always fun to talk with economists because they see things from slightly different angles than us supply chain folks. He earned his PhD in economics from Texas A&M and has served as chief economist, chief strategist, and other senior roles at UBS, JP Morgan, Moffitt & Nichol, and JLL prior to forming the Kempsies Group in 2020. In our wide-ranging conversation, we'll talk about challenges during the pandemic, the impact of fiscal stimulus and the great resignation on supply chains, as well as the congestion at the ports and how the backlog might be reduced. Following our discussion, I'll be joined by Dr. Ian Amiyub for the Truckload Market Update. So let's get started. Welcome to the Freightvine Podcast, Walter.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Chris.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen you for about a year or so. I think the last time was probably at a conference where we were both speaking. I always look forward to hearing your discussions because you're one who's never really timid or shy about expressing their opinions on economics and global supply chain. So I'm really excited to talk with you today.
No, likewise. I think it's been since at least 2019.
I think you're right. So before we start discussing 2021 and current things, tell us a little bit about the Kempsies Group, what it does. Give us some background on your perspective.
Yeah, I basically, Kempsies Group focuses on two things. One of them is port rail advisory on capital improvement planning. So that's you know, these days I don't lead those as much as I work for other firms, other engineering firms who are putting that together. Long range forecasting and planning is tricky business. And the older I get, the more depressing it is, because I realize it's, for some of the forecast horizons, the actuarial tables say you're not going to find out if you're right or wrong. But the other place where I get involved is the industrial real estate developers. Do a lot of advisory with them. And it's something that I slowly started to do in 2014, 2015. And what I noticed is that the industrial real estate development was heavily concentrated in New York and Southern California. It reminded me of my days when I was on Wall Street, where all of the big funds would follow each other. There was this herd mentality. You know, right. Thompson Fund was overweight technology, then so was I, because if it does well, great. And if it doesn't, I can say I was with the crowd on that. If they do it and I don't, and technology does well, I get to go find a new job. Well, industrial real estate is not that different. There's an awful lot of stay in the big market, stay where there's a lot of liquidity, stay where there's safety. But because of that, a lot of opportunities in smaller ports were missed. And so what I had told Jones Lang LaSalle, where I worked before I went off on my own, was that we would see a dramatic drop in the vacancy rate in the port markets around the country, and we would need serious investment in other places. So Savannah, for instance, where I work with the port here. I actually live here now and basically work with the industrial real estate developers in the area rather than the port. So the vacancy rate at the top 10 ports is running well below 5%. And in at least three of the gateways, you're looking at effectively 0% vacancy.
Now, Walter, is that pre-pandemic, and did the pandemic just accelerate, or did the trend change during the pandemic?
Yeah, this had started before the pandemic. Okay. So 2016, I did some work for a few ports, and I told them, you know, rule number one here, it's never about the port, it's about the gateway, right? The gateway is the port, the waterway, railway, et cetera, and the industrial real estate. And, whereas New York and L.A. were getting a lot of attention, all the other of the top 10 ports, not seeing a lot of money. So I'm not going to mention the funds here, but I went to see some of the biggest institutions in the world that are headquartered in New York, talked to them, and they said, well, this port market is off our list. We can't invest. They're too risky. And a few years later, and even till now, I get phone calls from folks who said, well, we should have listened to you.
Yeah.
It's like, you came down here, you saw the cards, you saw the volume growth, you talked to the port, you did this all over the place. You know, what made you think you know better than, you know, the experts in the supply chain? So anyway, so I'm still doing that, except I'm getting a lot more involved in the development side. And I thought, you know, the economics work could cause brain damage. Try getting new land into a market.
because at the ports, it's not just, you're right. It's not the port itself. It's that connection to the inland and on both ways, but also the sea land by the seaport tends to be crowded out by other interests, whether it's residential or other activities. Is that the challenge that you're finding, that the land is just where ports are now is just so congested with other development? Or do you think there's some other reason?
No, that's a really good question. You know, the first thing I learned when I left Wall Street and joined the port world is they said, if you've seen one port, you've seen one port. And so answer to the question is, you know, ports that have a huge local market like New York, L.A., Long Beach, you know, that have, you know, 40 to 70 million people within a half day's truck drive, right? Half day, so you can go there and then come back and sleep in your own bed. So for the drayage parts there, it's the problem is the cities and the local communities want to take away the port land and put condos and sports stadiums like in Oakland. They want to put the Oakland A's on, you know, on port property. And then when you get to the other markets, then you have problems like, zoning changes that are needed. And when you get a lot of fast growth, the local communities start getting upset. You know, they bought homes or they live in places that are kind of quiet. And now they're getting a lot of new construction of warehouses, distribution centers, and a lot of trucks coming through. And you're beginning to see, you know, the pace of change, especially in the smaller markets, generate a community reaction.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of that not in my backyard comes out by people for that. But let me ask you a question about that. Sometimes if you make infrastructure more efficient so that, say, the containers don't stay as long, that means less money is tied up in the local economy. And it pushes things through. Is that ever a pushback? Because if you make it seamless from the ship straight out 100 miles inland, say on rail or something, then all the local business doesn't benefit from that. Or am I off in the wrong direction?
Well, you know, yeah, that's always the knee-jerk reaction to that. And I had the same thing. And I've had either the pleasure or the difficulty of working with state DOTs. And the first time that came up to me when I was looking at one of the state freight movement plans, the DOT gentleman, who was extremely well educated, so he pulled me aside and he said, you think this port's going to do a lot of growth, a lot of volume growth? Yes. Do you want all of it going on the roads, or would you rather see an increasing share going on rails so that it doesn't choke the roads? You know, it goes, now take your hat off as an economist and become a local resident. What do you think? I'm like, yeah, I like this train business. It sounds good to me. So yeah, you know, if you have the ability, the space to add the roads, the capacity, like you can in places like Savannah, Charleston to some extent, Jacksonville,
right.
Fine. But if you don't, like New York and L.A., then you really want the rail to pick up the slack. In fact, that's why I think we're seeing a lot more inland ports these days.
Right, right. It's funny, you mentioned about state DOTs. I ran a series of workshops back 8-10 years ago where I had shippers, carriers, 3PLs, and then people from the government at the local, state, and federal levels. And it's the only time I've seen shippers and carriers get along, because they have someone from the government to both complain about. You know, so it's one of the you need that common enemy.
No, that's very well put. Although this may have changed a little bit because, the FMC is getting involved in a lot of the detention and demurrage. And it does seem like the FMC's advisors are stacked with users as opposed to service providers. But that's a recent thing, right? I mean, it's pretty chaotic. But going back to your point, yeah, absolutely. That's why the rail is important. The inland ports, we've seen inland ports finally, I think their day has come. The first inland port ever was the one in the Front Royal that the Virginia right. Port Authority did with NS. It's like a 210-mile shuttle. And that needed a subsidy for a couple of decades before it broke even. The second one was Ross Perot's out in Alliance, Texas. And that one also went a couple of decades, but less than Virginia's, to hit break even. And I spoke to the former CEO, the founder of CenterPoint, and he told me that he'd gone to see Ross Perot. Ross Perot told him a whole bunch of things not to do. And he claims he had a 7-year overnight success, which in the grand scheme of things, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So yeah. That was Mike Mullen. And, you know, one of the most interesting people I've met, you know, in the supply chain world.
So, Walter, but do you think that delay of decades to get a payback, do you think that was because of the time? And do you think it's shorter now that people are now more accepting to inland ports? Or do you think it'll always be several decades before they turn or break?
No. It's the demographics. You know, 10, 11 years ago, I had to work for a couple of ports on the West Coast, very big ones. They were being pestered by real estate developers and government officials who wanted the ports to start subsidizing inland ports all over the place. And so I wrote a report to explain why that wouldn't pay off for quite some time, but that in about 10 years, it would make sense because of demographic trends. And the demographic trends that I used were what the census was saying about the working age population. And they were forecasting very low rate of working age population growth. And according to the OECD, they say in the last couple of years, we've actually lost working age population. And then, you know, truck driving is not a great job. Truck drivers are not treated very well, according to them. I have a great article came out this weekend, and they don't like the electronic logging device. And so if you get to be if you're a baby boomer and you can retire, with this, you know, lousy coronavirus environment, you probably want to, because you want to make sure that you have a little fun before you, you know, kick the bucket. And so we've seen trying to put this as nicely as I can. So these guys are retiring. Not, you know, nobody told their kids they want them to grow up to be truck drivers. So we're not getting the young people filling those spots. And there is a chronic shortage of truck drivers starting 7-8 years ago that our friend Bob Costello, you know, over at the American Trucking Association has been documenting. So if you don't send stuff by truck, what do you do? Well, send it by rail. And rail has been growing its volumes faster. Rail remains cheaper on a per ton mile basis over a certain range. You know, not over a 10 mile range, but at some point, some distance, rail is the cheaper option.
Absolutely. It's never, but it's not necessarily the best option because of timing. I wish all intermodal was operating on its schedule and didn't have the congestion issues too, but they are faced with a lot of the same challenges as well as truck.
But they have to learn a little bit because, you know, the most successful division in a railroad was the coal division, right? Basically move the train A to B, right? From the mine, coal mine to the plant. And once you get good at that, and then you find out that coal is no longer desired, as we can see in the AAR's website, right? And every month, coal down relative to the past.
Yeah.
So they have to operate the train like a network. And I won't say which one said it, but one of the CEOs, oh, by the way, all the rail CEOs came up through the coal division, since it was the big division, the profitable one. And one of them said that railroads are not built to be operated like a network.
Yeah.
And I just sat there and I thought, I didn't expect that. I mean, when I look at the rail map, it looks like
a network. It is a network. It's a massive network.
So they've been getting very good at intermodal. If you look at the data, intermodal has been growing faster than any other category for the railroads.
They're doing
a better and better job. So I think we'll be okay. So the time for the inland ports wasn't 10 years ago. It was today. And when we advise people on developing property that's connected to rail, you know, I have a couple of tricks to make sure that you don't inadvertently cut off the rail connectivity attribute of the property by putting in guys, by letting whoever shows up first locate wherever the hell they want. You want to be careful with that. So that's a constant battle in getting these things to work. Sorry, Chris, that went on for too long.
No. But a point to that is the big downfall of rail is it can't go everywhere. It used to, and it was not profitable. I remember going to DCs. Older DCs will still have rail coming up through the back, but it's been cemented over for this. And so what I found since the 90s, when I started being in the business, I'm not quite as old as you, there was this competition between truck and rail. They didn't, cats and dogs, they wouldn't talk. And now I think it's gotten much more rationalized. There's a place for full truckload. There's a place for intermodal. There's a place for full rail. And they're starting to see mixing of people going from trucking to rail and vice versa. So I think it's getting, people are starting to recognize it as a system. But I agree, there is, it's hard to get rid of that mentality for coal because it's hard to change something that's been so successful for so long. And you have this new thing coming in and changing.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look, some of the trucking companies who became kind of 3PLs migrated onto buying trains, which are run by the class ones, but they own the train. It's basically a take or pay, right?
Yeah.
So they've been doing that. And I'm wondering when some of the big retailers who've been operating their own vessels during the pandemic don't look around and say, you know what, we want these trains to run on our schedule. Let's go buy some.
Boy, that's a big commitment. Trains are not cheap, especially with the infrastructure. We'll see. I mean, I think talking to some of those large retailers are some of the ones who chartered their own vessels, which caused its own problems at ports. I think that was a last gasp Hail Mary. And it seemed to pay off for them. Because Christmas, I mean, things, shelves were fine, right?
Yeah.
I think Christmas came, and for those large retailers who did it, it was a gamble that seemed to pay off. What do you think?
Well, I think so. And also the fact that a lot of them started trying to stock the shelves in May of last year.
Right.
The minute they saw the fan come on and something weird flying towards it, they said, you know what? We better start getting our stuff in. But we still didn't get all of our Christmas gifts. I've got a one gift coming on March 1st, in theory. And my son ordered it in November.
We joke that, I don't know if you saw, but retail sales in December were actually down. And so what we joked is that the Black Friday started on Labor Day. And it kind of ended early because people really advanced bought. Let's shift and let's talk about 2021, which was just a crazy year. What were the top one or two things that surprised you in 2021?
The first one, and there were two things that really stood out, was the government economic policies. Why we had to have another big fiscal stimulus last year was beyond me. I think that totally blew out the supply chains because it was fairly obvious by January that any money the government gave bored people who were at home, who actually did need a few things to work from home more comfortably or school from home, they went and they didn't just do that. They bought all kinds of stuff. You had the old guys who, you know, used Amazon for the first time and bought half a dozen fishing rods because they were a great deal. This administration and why we had to have another fiscal stimulus was just absolutely beyond. And both parties voted for it. It's not a political thing. It's politicians scared they wouldn't get reelected. So that blew up the supply chain. And then, of course, you know, the government has the audacity to tell the supply chain guys that they don't know what they're doing. No, sorry. Nobody prepares for this trillions of dollars of spending. But to me, the really interesting one, something I've been wondering about for quite some time, was the proletarian revolt, commonly known as the Great Resignation or whatever, you know, some management consulting firm came up with. Years and years ago, some decades ago, we went after this trickle-down theory and supply chain economics, although there was no evidence that that would ever work. And over the decades, the middle class got pretty squeezed. And when you read Pew Research and some of the stuff S&P Global, you know, the Wall Street credit rating agencies, their research said and others, it's pretty clear that people in the lower part of the middle class were struggling. They work three jobs. They don't really have good health care benefits. And they're constantly sleep deprived. And, you know, just doing whatever they can to get their families into a new place, you know, a better place than they were. And so I wondered how long that could go on. And then I gave up. And all of a sudden, you know, we start seeing this great resignation and people telling managers, what to do with the job. So that threw me off quite a bit.
Yeah.
But then the social behavior has worsened, you know, over the last 18 months. And that I did not expect. You know, I thought, we have a common enemy, we'll pull together. And it's like, we have a common enemy, let's, you know, use it against each other.
But that's a really interesting point. Do you think the Great Resignation, which I hate that name.
I do too.
By the way, because because there's a flip side to it. It's like some people stopped working, especially over the age of 50, a lot of early retirements. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But a lot of other people went somewhere else. And so I'm talking to a lot of people where suddenly I've got 100 new people who just started during a pandemic and they don't know my culture. And I have more new people coming in than were already there. And so it's almost like a realignment or, you know, how do I sustain my culture and my company with all these new people coming in? Because they're not all dropping out of the workforce. I think workplace participation number is still below pre-pandemic by a couple million. But still, there's a lot of shuffling going on.
Well, and it may not be an American thing. You know, I mean, for example, this, you know, the difference between people who would wear a mask and not wear a mask was in China, was in Germany and France and England, Brazil. I mean, you know, it wasn't a uniquely American thing. I mean, we tend to think it is because it gets so noisy that we forget to look around. So, you know, I have family in Europe and in Latin America, and they were complaining about the same things I was. So that's one issue. But the other thing that I my favorite newspaper is the South China Morning Post. And I I love reading that paper. I have now for 30 some years. And they had an interesting article. And I don't speak any you know Cantonese or Mandarin, but I think it was Teng Ping, T-E-N-G-P-I-N-G. It was a Chinese language version of laid back. And they were talking about what was scaring the Chinese government is you had these people who would take a job for a day, you know, kind of like you go to Snelling and you get a job working for a gardener. The next day you go back and you get one working for a moving company. I did stuff like that when I was a young man in college because I didn't have a lot of money. And that was how, you know, if you wanted to get a, you know, have some great entertainment for the weekend, you had to go earn it. But anyways, these guys will take a couple of jobs like that for 2 days. And then these folks will, for the next week, sit in park benches and, you know, live off the money that they made. And once it starts not being enough, then they'll go take a couple of those things. So, and in China, they had difficulty last year getting workers back to the factories. There are factories that are struggling. Vietnam has the same thing. Some folks, when they shut down Vietnam last August, they went home to the rural parts of the country and didn't come back. They said, it's not worth it. I don't want to eat, sleep, and live and work in the same place. It's disgusting.
But Walter, this is really interesting because this exact behavior, a lot of truck drivers have this, especially in the flatbed or the owner-operators, where instead of profit maximizing, they're going to a revenue target. If I get X thousand dollars this month, I stop and I go hunting. All right. And then next month I'll do it again. I've seen this for years and it's mainly on the smaller size companies. So we'll see if that continues. But, you know, it's not a bad life if you like to go hunting, you know.
No, but you see, have this idea. Yeah, the drainage guys, they do that because their kids have like Little League baseball or whatever. They're going to coach the team or whatever. And you know what? If I've done my five turns for the day, you know, I'm done. I've got more than enough to put dinner on the table. I'm going to go enjoy my life a little bit.
Do you think the increase, because what companies are doing is they're increasing wages, right? It's happening across the board. Do you think you're an economist, so I just have opinions. You have some educated opinions. Do you think this is transitory, or is it becoming more permanent? What do you think, the inflation that we're seeing?
I think companies are, you know, they have to drop the historical standards a little bit and not, you know, the minute, you know, the economy reopens is order everybody back to the office. It's fairly clear that the American workers want some flexibility on that. You know, if you're doing your work and you're getting it done on time or ahead of schedule, then why do you need some manager overwatching you? So we have a layer of management that's really not necessary. We've got electronic devices that can tell if I'm logged on and working on my computer. If I've got a company computer, I work from home. My company can run a quick IT check and see, you know, if I'm on or not. They can check your cell phone if it's a company issued one. And if you're out there pinging on that and you're getting your work done, why not? I've been working from home strictly since 2016, but even when I was a college professor back in the 80s, I worked from home a day or two. You know, my wife worked and I had to watch my kid And nobody cared. I used the internet. I mean, you know, I acoustic coupler, and I hooked into the university computers and, you know, kept on working.
Back in the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know what, though? That's different, though, Walter, because we tend to be in the, call it the, what, information or knowledge economy. So I can, we can do writing, we can do this kind of stuff. But if I'm in a physical side of things, I'm in a DC, in a manufacturing plant, then you don't have that option.
No, that's right? True.
And so I agree with you 100%, but you raised a really interesting point I hadn't thought about. Do you think that because the ability to work remotely is so accepted now, do you think that's going to lessen the middle management side? Do you think a lot of middle management will get, positions will get hollowed out?
I absolutely think so.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think just the middle management, but perhaps some of the senior management as well. I mean, we are automating stuff at a rapid pace. If you look, we've got 5G is installed all over the country, maybe a little too haphazardly if you ask the airlines, but nonetheless, it's there. And during the pandemic, the one thing that came out is something that makes me wonder if this next decade is going to be like the 1920s. So in the 1920s, in the beginning of the decade, a fifth of the population had electricity connected to their home. By the time we got to 1930, it was somewhere between 65 and 80%, depending on which source of lack of information. We don't have data for that period. But during that period, the number of households with radios, washing machines, telephones, cars, etc., went through the roof. People started moving to the suburbs. And an American in 1920 couldn't understand the America of 1930. It was so different. You know, Manhattan only had horse and buggy in 1920. In 1930, it was all vehicles, buses, right? And so in the last 10 years, I've had internet, I've had a cell phone, I've had all of the stuff I have today. But, you know, in the last 10 years, I didn't change the way I live from one year to the next. But with all of these things that have now been deployed, with more people having access to the internet, with 5G and Starlink, we saw the other day when Tonga suffered horribly from that volcano. SpaceX said, hey, look, we've got Starlink. Would you like us to drop off a couple of receiver there and get your communications going? I think we're on the verge of an amazing decade where if we were to go to 2030 today, we'd be lost, you and me. Whereas if in 2010 we traveled to 2019, we wouldn't be lost. We'd be like, oh, the computers are a little better. But so what, right? At 2030, I think we'll look back and say we could not have imagined this 10 years ago. And I think that applies to supply chain. I mean, to me, the most backward thing in our economy is supply chain. Yeah, I mean, we don't have supply chain visibility. I mean, we have all of the tools you need for it, right? We've got equipment tracking stuff, RFID, things you can stick on the side of a chassis or of a container, etc. But you still have, you know, except for the really big companies, everybody else, the supply chain guy gets up in the morning and he goes to a port website and an ocean carrier website and a railroad and a trucking guy, makes a few phone calls, slaps all that stuff into a spreadsheet that says how much of this stuff is here, here, and here. And then they send it out to the company as a whole. And if something looks bad, you say, I'm not sure, but I think we need to be careful with our shipments coming into the port of X. And I mean, you're not even sure about it because you don't know where your stuff is. And you spent 3 hours doing this. There's no excuse for that. I mean, you're more on the cutting edge of technology than I am, Chris. And I was wondering what you think.
Yeah, I think there's pockets. It's not uniformly spread. There are some companies that there were, it's end to end. And you have companies like Four Kites out there, MacroPoint before they were acquired by Descartes, and others that are able to do it. It's just the cost of it. It's just the cost. Just like I would say, I think you're right. Going back 10 years, 2020, forget the pandemic, would look, you know, wouldn't be that different. If I went back to 2000 or the 90s, maybe, because I remember in the 90s disappearing for 3 days and say, hey, I'll call you when I get whatever, or sending letters. So the idea of being constantly connected to me was a foreign concept in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And now I think people start hyperventilating if they're not connected. Just like, could you imagine if there was no electricity for a week? The economies would shut down.
Oh my gosh, it'd be horrible.
And the internet is not far behind that. Without the internet, whenever there's a blackout, I go, thank God I still have cell because I can still have my internet.
Well, what you can't see in my office here is I've got a universal power supply. I actually have two of them. And I can run my computer, my wife's computer, and our television and our mobile, you know, our internet. The rest of the stuff, that's okay. If the food in the freezer melts, it's all right. But we don't want to be disconnected.
It's your internet. That's right. You have tins of tuna somewhere too, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, stockpiled.
Yeah, my dog still eats canned food, so we're good.
Oh, that's funny. So we talked about 21, and those are true things, the great resignation and the protests, just the social change. And we're finding this now, labor unions are much stronger right now, and they're in bargaining power. We're seeing it across the different unions. And so I'm curious if you have any thoughts along that and how that will affect things in the short term going into 22. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think the wage increases that we're seeing, they will continue to be relatively high. I know the macro data shows some low number like 4 to 6% year on year. But if you look at the county employment report that the census puts out, of the top 300 counties, about half of them are looking at, you know, double digit wage increases on a year on year month versus a year ago month. And about a third of them are well into the double digits, like 20-30%.
So, Walter, that's really interesting, the disparities between the different counties. But when do you think this will all actually end? When do you think everything will become normalized?
Well, one thing it's debated quite a bit, but basically it's when is everything stable again? I think it won't happen this side of the Chinese Lunar New Year. I know that there are a lot of factories in China offering $300 for you not to go home for the Lunar New Year.
Wow.
Yeah, but I think folks are going to go home anyways because, you know, I think the psychological pain that people are feeling from this bizarre environment is too much. And I think you're better off letting them go home and, you know, kind of clear their minds a little bit and then come back with, maybe able to sustain productivity levels, et cetera. But I think before the end of the second quarter, we could be back to normal. I'm wondering about volume growth because there's a lot of stuff that arrived really late. Like the other day, it cracked me up, but I saw, Paul Page's commentary that some ships arriving had containers full of Halloween stuff. What are you going to do with it? Well, you're going to put it in the warehouse and wait till next Halloween, right?
Yeah, the question is, who pays for that? Who's paying the demurrage charges? Who's paying for the cost of the inventory? I mean, someone. I wonder if, because at some point, I wonder if the value of the stuff that's in the container is lower than the fees that they have to pay, and you just don't even pick it up.
No, I'm sure that is definitely the case. We all saw what happened, you know, to the train coming out of LA the other day, and we learned about all the pilfering, which kind of, you know, sounds like other countries where these things happen too. But anyway.
Yeah, there's a lot of finger pointing there, a lot of finger pointing back and forth. But let's get to the ports now, where your area of expertise, you're much more knowledgeable on this than I am. The counting of ships off of LA is something even my family comments on, my brothers and sisters, because finally they know what a supply chain is now. And so when do you think, first, why is it there? When do you think it'll dissipate? What will it take for it to dissipate? Because I think, what is the number now? Is it over 100 still waiting somewhere off of the port?
But most of them more than 40 nautical miles away.
By law.
Yeah, because a lot of those ships were sitting there for, 2 to 6 weeks and, burning bunker. And, that's just, it makes for an unhealthy atmosphere. I mean, I get people wanting the ships to go park elsewhere if they're going to stick around that long. So, so the numbers dropped from triple digits to back over triple digits. Other ports ran into the same problem, so all of the top 10 at one time or another had a ship or two, get stuck waiting to get into the berth, and some a lot more than a ship or two. What's interesting to me is the distribution centers and the warehouses around the ports, the vacancy rate around them is well below 5%, and most of them it's below 2. The local warehouses and distribution centers started to rent trailers and hang on to containers on chassis because they just didn't have enough room at the end.
Right.
And so they left the rest of their stuff at the ports, and some of the ports saw literally a doubling of long-dwelling containers at the terminal. Now, this is bad because some of these boxes started ending up encroaching in the apron, the area where you work the ship. And a long-dwelling container is like a long-dwelling restaurant guest, right? You know, if you sit there for 4 hours and you could have served four meals, you want to choke the guy. So it does impact the productivity at the port. So the good news is the number of boxes occupying static storage space has definitely dropped across the port industry. But we still have problems around cities. You still have containers being parked on chassis in all kinds of odd places, as well as the importer's location. Where I live, there's a Kroger's, and I always drive behind the Kroger's to go home. A, it's safer than driving in the front. But also, because being a supply chain geek, you know, I like to see what's going on. And I can tell you that for 3 or 4 months last year, I had a half a dozen to a dozen chassis with international containers parked behind the Kroger's. And I thought, wow, I guess they were hiding from the cops, because you'll get ticket for doing that. But that's how far this thing had gone. So we have the problem was the inventory couldn't leave the ports and go to interior locations. The railroads didn't have enough employees. At one point, remember, the West Coast railroads had 45 miles of rail cars waiting to get into Chicago.
Right. Right.
And then long haul trucking, we've had a shortage. And so as the stuff starts to leave the distribution centers near the ports and go inland, that'll be the first sign of stabilization. But right now, as far as I can tell, the DCs and warehouses at port cities are still zero extra capacity.
Yeah.
But once we see that happen and stuff moving inland, I think that's the true beginning of the end.
Yeah, because I know if I talk to a lot of carriers and shippers, a lot of times the trailer pool isn't there for them. You know, the empties aren't waiting because the company hasn't unloaded the ones they brought in before. And so there aren't empties to take out. And it's because the shipper isn't doing it, you know, on purpose. It's they don't have the labor force in the DC to unload it, or their DCs are full with the wrong stuff. And so it's really, I don't know what's going to be the break, what's going to break the log jam. And will it take, what's your best guess for the, when the number of ships will go down to low double digits or high single digits?
Okay, well, you know, our exports haven't done very well, and certain kinds of exports haven't done well. And I call my friends who run the distribution centers for exports to see if they've stopped renting their empty space to retailers who are importing things.
Oh, I see.
I learned that last year around September. It flabbergasted me. Right? It's an old-fashioned word. I was just like, what? And they go, yeah, well, you know, we have this million-square-foot thing. We only need 200,000 square feet, so we rent it the other 400,000 to importer A and another 400,000 to importer B.
Wow.
And it's worked really well. The other thing is, if you go inland, I mean, you'll find a lot of old economy businesses that have tons of storage space that they haven't put in on the market yet. So there's this company called Warehouse Exchange. It's run out of LA. And basically, they get warehouse space that are no longer being used as much. And they put it on the market, kind of like an Uber thing, put it on the market, and people who need a little space can go get it. So if you look at like newspaper companies, they still have their warehouses, but newspaper circulation, you know. Now, so what do you do with all that space? Come on, man.
Interesting.
Rent it, you know, put it on the market. So
it's like Airbnb for containers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So we haven't seen enough of that pickup because of the difficulty moving is a lot of stuff very quickly. A lot of stuff, I mean a lot of stuff coming in on hundreds of ships very quickly to locations where you can find, you know, empty space. And it is so once we see that that there's more room at the inn, at the port cities, at the DCs, and that to me is the sign that we are now on the mend. And I would argue that if you look back to 2016, when we were messed up over the ILWU strike, it only took us like 6 to 8 weeks to straighten it out, which brings up a good point. Next June 30th is a very important date. It's the ILWU contract expiration.
And 23.
Yeah, that's right. It's this year on June 30th, right?
Of 22?
Yeah.
Of 22. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize. I thought it was in 23 because I know the UPS master contract is up in 23.
Right. I was told 22. I haven't looked at their contract.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I believe it. I believe it.
So
that's going to be interesting.
Yes, it will be. So we talk, you know, earlier we were talking about labor, you know, not liking certain jobs and leaving to get paid more, et cetera. So I'm wondering what will happen with the ILWU. But, you know, I think importers, if they're paying attention, probably should be finding some space on the East Coast. That would be very difficult because the port cities themselves have very little. You'll have to go a couple, 100 or more miles inland to find anything.
Right.
So,
interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. I had an importer ask me to help them in Norfolk. I kept a straight face. Just said, you know, unless you're going to build there, there's nothing. And the best option would have been something in Richmond. You know, it would be your closest option.
Yeah, but getting from Norfolk to Richmond is only truck, right? Is there much rail going in from Norfolk into Richmond?
Well, they also have a container on barge. They have the St. James, the James River Barge Corporation.
Really?
Yeah. I worked on that way in the early days. I helped them get a CMAQ grant, you know, was congestion mitigation air quality grants.
Yeah.
To help get the business started. They changed operators, but no, it works real well. In fact, I think they're about to add more stops and run more frequently.
I just didn't think the James made it navigable that all the way up to Richmond. I used to live in Richmond.
Oh, really?
I have a bunch of family there.
Yeah, well, if you come from the south of 95, there's the port of Richmond. And they used to get container ships, small ones, you know, nothing really that big. But
interesting.
And then 10 years ago, nobody came anymore. The last guys pulled out. And so the state gave Richmond to the Virginia Port Authority. And I was there when that happened. So I kind of know the story pretty well.
Interesting. Interesting. So, Walter, last question.
Yeah.
And then we'll let you go. Really enjoyed talking with you about this. So we expect in 2022 for the pandemic to ease or become endemic at some point, and life will go on a little more normal. What are your thoughts about post-pandemic? What are some silver linings, if any, that you discovered during the pandemic that you think you will continue on post-pandemic?
I think one of them is the extended use of technology. I think we've leapfrogged a lot of You know, when you diffuse technology, we talk about diffusion like a nice, smooth, continuous thing. No, it isn't. It goes by leaps and bounds.
Yeah, yeah.
So that to me has absolutely changed. I saw the grocery guys in the U.S. could not get e-commerce, last mile delivery of groceries working, as opposed to Europe. When I lived in London in the 90s, it sucked because I lived in a part of town where you had to park in the street. And if you bought ice cream on a hot summer day, it was going to be soup by the time you got it out because you had to find a parking space. So my wife got angry and said, look, give it up. And she signed up with three supermarkets and we did e-commerce for groceries in 1998. Now, America, we couldn't get it to work because most of us live out in rural suburban areas, etc. We drive everywhere. So you didn't have that pressing need. So I think that has changed. Now, I don't think we're seeing the final version of this yet, but for sure, the e-commercization, I guess, of grocery shopping has definitely changed.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? What's really taken off is not just pure online, order at home, order online, get it at home, is BOPIS, where you order it online, but you pick up in the store.
Yes.
Buy online, pick up in store. And that has gone, I was just talking to someone from a large retailer, went expounded dramatically through the pandemic and is not going away because you're right. We tend to be a driving community, but if I'm juggling my kids' appointments and classes and I can just zip into the store, they load the bags in and I go home. That's better than waiting for an appointment. And so I think it's starting to take off.
Let me make 2 points in that. One is I had to shop in my supermarkets, you know, family health issues. We literally shut down. I mean, we didn't go anywhere for at least 6 months. We had our groceries delivered. And in the beginning, it was okay. But then the supermarket decided they needed to mark up groceries that would go through e-commerce, even though it didn't change their costs. Then the e-commerce guys added a new charge. And then they also suggested that you tip the grocery deliverers. So what would have cost me $50, you know, before this was now over $120. And so as soon as I summed up the courage, I had to put the mask on, douse myself in cleanser and, you know, I think that those guys overcharged and they made a mistake. I think that people did exactly what you said. They learned to use this other model. But it also makes me think that as we get these autonomous vehicles to work in small areas, that in a few years, you might actually send your level 5 car over to the supermarket to pick up the groceries you ordered.
Yeah.
That's 2030 for me, man.
we can have another discussion about autonomous vehicles. I'm more of a skeptic than many other people are, but maybe in a contained small area.
Right.
Walter, I really enjoyed talking with you. You always bring up things that I wouldn't have thought of. So thanks again for joining me today.
It's a lot of fun to be here, Chris. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Okay, everyone, please stay tuned to hear the market update with Dr. Enam Yu.
Welcome to the Over the Road Truckload Market Update for January 27th, 2022. In today's market update, we will discuss the market changes in the last 2 weeks. Let's start with dry van. Active rates are up 0.5%, spot rates up 3%, and replacement rate is positive 20%. This means the new contract rates are about 20% above the rates being replaced. On the temp control side, active rates are down 0.5%, spot rates down 0.5%, and replacement rate positive 8%. On the intermodal side, active rates are down 0.5%, spot rates are flat, and replacement rates are positive 12%. Finally, on the flatbed side, active rates are up 5%, spot rates up 1%, and replacement rate is negative 3%.
All right, so Enam, there's some really confusing signals here. The active rates are kind of flat, up a little bit for dry van, temp control, intermodal, but very large replacement rates. What do you think's going on?
I think it's still this. We are still seeing maybe partial of the new bid results coming in because most companies will roll out their Q4 bids in January. So I think we're still seeing parts of that.
Yeah.
So I would say to give a little bit more time to understand the true effect of the bid outputs. But I would assume those are the big impacts that's coming now.
Yeah. And spot rate for dry van bumped up a little higher than it was. It was flat last time and now it's up 3%. Do you think that's going to continue or what do you think is causing that?
I think it's more in situational events. I think there was a northeast, the sudden freeze that came through. I think Omicron is also, I think, having localized effects. I think even if you look at local communities, I think schools are shutting down because lack of teachers, school bus drivers, and so forth. So all of that's getting disrupted, not to a large scale, but I think all of that is contributing towards it.
Right, but the Omicron effects, you're dead on. I think this is the Omicron variant is less deadly but more contagious. So the danger is not that people are necessarily dying or getting really sick, but that they're being quarantined for 5 days and it's like a rolling sick out. But that has ripple effects. So it's local to a community, but that will have a ripple effect. If you can't load quickly at this DC, that slows down delivery to the next DC. So how do you think that'll play out? Do you think that'll continue? Or do you think that'll we'll work that out in the next couple of weeks?
I would hope it'll work out in the next few weeks because all the talk has been that the spike is not going to hold that long. So I think that's the hope. And, but if to your point, it does kind of has that ripple effect. You know, the drivers are still getting frustrated because of the long waiting times for unload, load, which follows on to lack of capacity because you're sitting in the drive, docks rather than driving. So I think it has the effects, but, we are not seeing a spike in actual demand, right? So I think that is there, but I think this all the disruptions are coming through.
Yeah, what's interesting is that makes it back to like the spring of 21 is that things are happening unevenly across the United States. So up here in New England, we're peaking and we're down. We're down like 30% in Massachusetts cases from 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. We peaked in the first week of January. Texas, which still refuses to recognize that a pandemic is going on, hasn't peaked yet. And so because all the supply chains are connected,
it's going to keep rippling through in unseen and weird ways.
Yeah, I think it's surprise, surprise for Texas always. But but the issue is, I think this is where the larger discussion comes in the time of pandemic. Is it a, you know, should you work, do things on a localized way or more on a national level? But I think that's a different conversation.
Yeah, and actually, I'm just looking at the stats for Texas. It has come down. You guys seem to have peaked in a week ago. And so we'll see how it goes. But it seems like it's about a month-long surge for Omicron. And maybe it's the best thing that's happening because we're hitting, you know, quote, herd or super immunity, and more people will be safer. But we'll see. We'll see. Any last thoughts on the market?
No, I think, again, the quick this thing is spot rates are rising again.
Yeah.
And the shippers, I think they're better equipped to do that now. I think they are having more surgical approaches to go
after. Yeah, they're battle tested after 2 years of the pandemic, right? Everyone's pretty much used to the chaos. All right. Well, that concludes this week's Truckload Market Update. Thanks, Enam.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Freight Find. The Freight Find podcast is hosted by Dr. Enam Ayub and myself, Chris Kaplis, and is produced and edited by DATIQ. For more information or to hear previous episodes, please visit our website at dat.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to The Freight Find wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to give us a review. As always, if you have any feedback or questions about what you've heard on The Freight Find or suggestions for what you'd like to hear in the future, send an email to me at chris.kaplis@dat.com. Finally, from all of us at The Freight Find, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new.